Welcome back to the seventh season of my podcast. I'm making a couple of changes for 2024, namely moving episodes to fortnightly to create a more realistic workload and publishing on Thursdays. You probably know by now that I work with companies to help them understand what's getting in the way of people having the best experience and performing well. Whether that's about work culture, leadership and management, mental well-being or engagement, I strip back the noise to uncover what's really going on. And then together we create a meaningful, innovative and sustainable approach to address those challenges. And that's what I'll be discussing with my guests. It's all about putting the human factor back into business. Because when we get people right, we get business right. I want to give a quick shout out about Leadership and Manager Labs, because I'm facilitating those with the fabulous Gemma Ellison of Heart Leadership. If you're interested in a space and community dedicated to development via a process of experimentation that gives us permission to analyse, test, review and learn, all within a human-centric framework, get in touch. Details in the show notes. I'm your host, Lisa, psychologist and psychotherapist and founder of It's Time for Change. Thank you for joining me on Beyond the Water Cooler. So I'd like to welcome James Elliott, who's head of psychotherapy at the Serena Clinic, to the show today. Thank you for joining me, James.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Is it James or is it Jim?
James is like business. Jim, Jimmy, Jimothy, Jimbo, Jumbo Sana, like all of that, that's all military guys and rugby guys who still know me as all of that.
Okay.
So I tried to change it, but it's interesting. It's a bit like in the Godfather, not that I'm in any way comparing myself to the Godfather, where people who know him from different parts of his life refer to him in different ways until, unfortunately, everybody by the third movie only ever knows him as the Godfather. And nobody knows him as Mikey anymore. So it's a little bit like that. So I go by James to try and be more sound.
Okay.
It's like, yeah.
Okay. We're being grown up. So you've got over 13 years, I think, experience in the army. And,
yep,
and you have a specialism in the army around mental health and or mental resilience coaching, which I think it sounds like that must have been a pretty tough gig in that particular context, working with soldiers or working with army personnel around mental resilience.
It was. And do you know what the really interesting, so I love that. So I love that time of my career. So like the last 2 years of my career I was second in command of British Army's OpSmart mental resilience training. So I was basically in the south of the country and I had to go to all of like the units in the south of the country, although like I was in York at certain points and Catterick, so like whatever, but like army math.
Yeah.
But I was in all of these different units and it was just so interesting to see like cultures of units and how the different cultures of the different units would respond differently to the idea of resilience training. So you would assume, simply by bias, that things like paratroopers, commandos, special forces guys would be really standoffish to the idea of resilience and mental health, whilst like less combat orientated units like logistics and the band would be like really more understanding of it. But actually it was the other way round, which was so interesting. So when I talked about resilience as a performance enhancer, lots of like the more combat or what we would call like punchy units were really, really into it. And stuff that, and I know that this is a really, really basic level of understanding, but like even like with some of the SF guys, some of the special forces guys, sorry for those SF guys, and or like the powers of commandos guys, even like lots of them there had read the Chimp Paradox. Which you wouldn't associate for units like that. And I know that's like, but that's a great start point, like a brilliant start point. So they had read like the Chimp Paradox. So talking about, oh, is that's my inner chimp that you're talking about there, right, Jim? And you're like, yeah, effectively, mate, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And they would understand about learned behaviors. And that was really fantastic. And yet sometimes you go to other units and guys would be like, why do we even care about this? Like, why do we need to know about that? But you would know because you had been told that, well, actually, your amount of medically downgraded because of mental health issues here is statistically, you're in the bottom sort of 2%, you know, of the military. Like this is a really, really poor unit for mental health and for caring for young soldiers. So you definitely should be listening to this. So it was really interesting. It was the exact opposite way around to what I thought it would be. But yeah, it was a tough gig. And it was a tough gig because of the different cultures of every unit. And that's not just their attitudes towards mental health, it's their attitudes towards work and welfare, And of course, well-being underpins performance, but there was just such an interesting, like there was like a canyon between like the old and bold who were like, just get on with it, stop being pathetic, and these younger generations that were like, it's actually way more complicated than that, and you don't really understand the issues that we're facing. So, I mean, I know that that's almost like straight into the topic of the conversation you want to talk about today, but it was really interesting that there were so many of this sort of older generation who were Sierra Leone, Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, early days Afghanistan, who were like, get on with it. Like, we don't talk about this, we fight on. And then this younger generation that were saying, I don't feel valued, I don't feel heard, I don't feel appreciated, using language that the senior ranks hadn't even heard of. But that's not true in all cases. There were like lots and lots and lots of very fantastic officers and very, very fantastic seniors, you know, and people being like so into this. But then there was, you know, this huge gap, and it was so interesting.
It really mirrors, though, what's happening in a lot of companies at the moment in terms of people, younger generations saying, actually, I want X, Y, or Z, and this is what I want my experience to be like. And actually, other people saying, well, you just got to get on with it. You just got to crack on. Just be grateful you got a job, you've got some income, really challenging times right now, and you can't be fussy. So I think there are definitely parallels there.
Yeah, for sure. I saw an interview with Alan Sugar, and I know that he's very much a brand and a character that generates income for him. But he was on whatever news channel it was, and he was saying, we need to do away with this work from home. Stop being pathetic. Get into work. We need to start bringing people back into the office. Now, firstly, we have to acknowledge the fact that one of his businesses is in corporate real estate. So it's very self-serving for him to say, work from home is over, come back into the office. Like that's a huge source of income for him. But secondly, I think that shows like the ridiculousness in that gap, because if work is electronically based, bear with me about how like ridiculous that term seems, but like if your work is you sat on a laptop, why do you have to be sat in an office to be sat on your laptop? If you can sit at home and if you can achieve more on your laptop with home comforts, being able to do the school run, what's the issue?
And that's you know what? We should have that as another conversation, because that's like that's a big topic, isn't it? And a very, very relevant one right now.
Yeah.
What I would love, so before I even properly ask you to explain a bit about who you are, I've just got to get this in, because I saw on your LinkedIn profile, and I didn't know this about you, despite the fact that you and I have done a little bit of work together many years ago, that you have some Guinness World Records. And so clearly you're someone who likes to push yourself. Tell us briefly about that and what makes you kind of pursue those things.
I've got five world records. So I've got the Guinness World Record for the longest game of rugby sevens. So I played me and a sort of military, I say military dream team, but like, like Fizz Monsters, we did rugby sevens for 24 hours straight. It's actually 24 and a half hours straight, because Guinness wouldn't accept less than 24 hours. So we did 24 hours and 30 minutes straight of rugby. So we played against like a mixed opposition, and it was us, and you were allowed to rotate. So it was 12 of us all in all in a squad. So you're allowed to rotate. But yeah, that was horrible. So I lost all of my toenails about 18 hours in, which was hard. And then a year later, we did the same again, but it was rugby 10. So there's 10s of you on a pitch with a squad of 15. So we did the same again. And I fractured a metatarsal in my wrist at the 16-hour point. So I then played like 8 hours of rugby 10s, full contact. This is all competitive rugby. It took like 6 months to get the certificate, because Guinness sit and watch every second to make sure that we're not blagging it. Like, it was full contact. And I then had to play like, it was like 8 hours with like this fractured wrist. My hand had like ballooned up. And we then got the world record. So then I went with a Fit Expo, and we did the most amount deadlifted in a group of 12 in an hour. So there's loads of like, got a load of powerlifters together, and we did deadlifting, and we deadlifted 260,000 kilograms, something like that, in an hour. And then on the same day, me and one other guy said, well, let's set it up for the bench press. And then we did it again. So I did the deadlift, and then I did the bench press one. And that was 140,000 kilograms that we bench pressed between 12 of us. The buff I had that night, I couldn't get out of the buff. I was there just like drowning, I help. So we did that. And then I've got the Guinness World Record for the most amount of people eating fish and chips at any one point. And we got, it was right at the end of COVID, and we got everyone together, and we all did it digitally. And we did there were 300 odd of us eating fish and chips together.
Oh, just a nice
thing to do, just trying to get people together for like a bit of community spirit. So yeah, that. So, those were exciting.
I love that. And so you've gone from something the eating fish and chips feels a bit more as a relaxed activity compared to the other ones. So, and now you're head of psychotherapy at the Serena Clinic.
Mm.
So tell us a little bit about how you got into that. Like, what has brought you, because you know, you've got all this military experience, you're someone who's really pushes yourself, you're into endurance, you're very focused on mental health. What got you into doing something like what you do now?
Well, I had like quite a lot of difficulty with my own mental health, like a lot of soldiers from the early 2000s. When I joined in 2006, I was recruited from a low socioeconomic demographic. I was struggling with homelessness and drugs and violence and all sorts. And so got to like 2015, I was having like real challenges with my own mental health. And so I had to take time and go through my own therapeutic journey. And at the time, because I was given like so much time off of work because of my mental health, I got involved in my local rugby club, which is Colchester RFC, which had just promoted into National League Rugby. So that's like the top 5% of like rugby in the UK. And I started strength conditioning coaching there. I enjoyed strength conditioning coaching, obviously enjoy like the fizz side of it. But what I really, really enjoyed was like connecting with like those young players and just finding that actually I was getting far more of a performance out of them by the conversations that we could have with like these really young, very impressionable young rugby players, some of them who went on to go play like Exeter Chiefs and Cornish Pirates, like Premier League teams.
Mm.
So doing this work with them, I was like, oh, I love that. And I just basically started studying. So I started doing like diplomas in like sports psychology to like just give me a bit of a better toolbox. And then went from there into advanced psychology, and when I was leaving the army, I used like as much time as I could to really take advantage of that to like really try and push my understanding of mental health. And then I got picked up by King's College and went and did a master's and I fell in love with originally just working with these athletes who just never really had any of these conversations before. And like the conversations were like really basic, like, you know, I was going through my mental health journey at the time. I didn't, you know anything really about mental health, but we just have just someone just there to like listen to them and have these conversations who like genuinely really believed them. There's a player there who's actually now at times been the captain and the old coach, who was a very old school coach, very like 90s rugby coach. He said to me, no matter how much I get in his face and how aggressive I get and how much I shout at him, he's such a big guy, but he never gets worked up. He never gets angry. And then my response was, but then why do you keep doing it?
Mm.
So then having this conversation with this guy and just trying to instill this like genuine self-belief, like taking him into the gym, I taught him how to deadlift and he picked up 300 kilograms. And you're like, you're deadlifting 300 kilograms, mate. You're a monster. Like, you're not human. Like, that's unbelievable. And so just giving him that confidence and then just watching him play now, you know, every now and then he's had the captain's armband on.
Mm.
And you're looking at that and you're going, that's incredible. Yeah. That's self-belief. But by taking a different approach, and that 90s rugby coach, that was very much a reflection as well of like the training that our seniors and within the military would have had, where everything was, I'm going to shout at you until you do it. Mm-hmm. But if that shouting doesn't work, they have nothing in their toolbox.
Yeah.
So just going, actually, there's a better way of doing it. And my next job in the military after that was working as a parachuting instructor at the RAF School of Parachuting, number one parachute training school in Bryce Norton. And so we went down there and I got the job because I was basically told, you've done a fantastic job at Colchester Rugby Club. That's been noticed by the brigade. Like, I got fully upgraded with my mental health because that massively helped having that purpose and identity. So then going down to Bryce Norton and being able to work in the parachute training school, I then took a different mentality of rather than all of the kind of experience that I'd had as a coach, as a young soldier, which is, I'm going to shout, I'm an army instructor, looking for a perfect demonstration on the word of command one, you know, like, and just that ridiculous, bolt rigid army way of giving instructions to then like just saying, right, lads, like, listen in, like, parachuting is a really unnerving thing to do. It's not natural. It's actually like really overwhelming. And I've got to tell you, when I was your age and I was here and I was 18 years of age becoming a young paratrooper, I was terrified. Like, I would joke with them, the first 10 jumps I did were all night jumps because of my eyes shut. I could just panic, get to the door, my eyes closed, 18 years of age, and getting pushed out. You just get pushed out. Like, no, good lads, we're not doing that. I'm not in the business of that. I want you to understand what's going on. So, God forbid, you might actually learn to enjoy it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So this is what we're going to do. And having those conversations then really, really changed the outcome of a lot of their parachuting. You know, a lot of them performed a lot better. There were a lot less injuries. And actually some of them, like, dare I say, did actually quite enjoy elements of it. Teaching them to understand and accept the fact that it's really scary because it's really unnatural to jump out of an aeroplane, particularly with kit and weapons tied to your legs. Like, that's horrible, but you're doing great. And this is all the stuff we've got to reassure you. And to that, and like that, I mean, ultimately what you wanted to talk about today, that does transpire from that into like the modern workplace. Like, lots of people are overwhelmed and lots of people are really struggling, but almost we're still taking that early 2000s military instructor approach to it of, well, just get on with it, just get on with it, just get on with it, you know? Yeah.
And I think what you're saying about kind of that, you know, how we approach just telling people what to do, and it's like, well, this is what we've got to do, so you just got to crack on and do it. There are so many managers who have had zero training and development and support in terms of how to model, how to be vulnerable, how to be honest and open and explore, right? This is what we've got to do. How are we going to achieve that together? Like, let's think about what this looks like and what our part is in achieving that. They default to what their experience.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Which is, I tell my team what they should be doing, when they should be doing it by, and I'm going to either micromanage or I'm dictating, I'm shouting the orders, which is so different to what you just explained in terms of, you know, you can have that model. It's not particularly successful. Lots of people are now objecting to that, and that's causing part, you know, we're seeing that in companies now, the rates of attrition and so on. But actually, for someone to say, this is what we need to do, this is how it feels, this is what my experience was like, it's modeling psychological safety.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. So I think to really, you've like highlighted two things there. So first and foremostly, in the military, and I was guilty of saying this as a young leader myself. I'll never obviously say it now, but as a young leader, people would say, well, it happened to me and it didn't do me any harm. But when I think about that statement, I think, if you're willing to acknowledge that something was a terrible experience, but you're willing to do it to somebody else, I've got to tell you, it definitely did harm you. Like, and the stuff that used to go on obviously was like, you know, like atrocious, like getting punched in the face as a young soldier was deemed acceptable. Like, nobody batted an eyelid. That would happen in front of regimental headquarters. Nobody would react to that. No one would respond. Nobody would care, which is fine because that was the culture of the time. But the second point is that I read this great book the other day, and the book is called The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read. A couple of people have like spoken about it, and I read it, and basically the point of the book is your parents didn't know what they didn't know. And we cover this. So my MSc is in war psychiatry. So one of the things that we did is we did like this really deep dive look into like British cultures towards mental health, which has been so greatly affected by the First and Second World War. But even like before then, like with the return of the Red Coat Army from like the Napoleonic Wars, and actually loads of like mental health came back to the UK. We just introduced it, like the 1824 Vagrancy Act, and said, well, it's illegal to have a breakdown in public. We've only ever hidden it, and we never really talked about it. But I actually think the same thing happens when it comes to like leadership. So like, your leaders didn't know what they didn't know. Back then, if you were caught, quote unquote, gobbing off, you would, quote unquote, be filled in. So if someone would just take you around the back of a wagon and punch you in the mouth, and that was absolutely fine. Like, nobody batted an eyelid to that. Now, there was a point in my career whereby they lost what's called crown immunity. So like, health and safety stuff of like, it's like we're in the army, like health and safety doesn't apply to us. And it absolutely should have. Yeah, I'm not like negating the need for health and safety, but it had like a thing called crown immunity. And one of the huge things that changed was, how do we treat our young soldiers? Like, you can't hit young soldiers. Now, that may seem like ridiculous, of course you can't. But at the time when I was like a very junior leader, and there were guys who were like senior corporals, were like, well, how are we supposed to discipline them then? That, like, they didn't know, like, we didn't know what we didn't know. You are just expected to change. And it was actually one of the things that I often find myself reflecting upon, which is then the seniors that would then charge the junior ranks for behavior like that, I found to be deeply hypocritical. I'm not saying they shouldn't have been charged, but the sergeant major who's punishing that fall screw for grabbing a private soldier, I'm going, but he learned that from you. And you were really known for that behavior, like far worse than he ever was. But you don't know what you don't know. And similar to that of our parents, whereby this, the point of this book is to say, you almost can't really judge your parents. You can obviously in, like, you know, cases of abuse and stuff, of course, but you can't really judge your parents for not knowing how to raise a child when their only experience of it was, you know, like their dad was raised by a guy who survived the Second World War, who was raised by a guy who survived the First World War. We consider how bad mental health is post-COVID. Imagine like how awful it must have been there. And the same really is done of like leadership, whereby you get people in like senior leadership positions who their managers were just ridiculous. Like the idea that someone could have a sick day because they've got poor mental health to them would, like, they would fire them on the spot for that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, that whole thing about parents, if you think about the, you know, and this brings us on to what we're actually talking about today, which is around kind of like looking at the future generation coming into our workforce. So looking at children, young people today who are going to be coming in, they're going to be the people we're employing in the future. So how do we make sure that they're in the best place? And so that ultimately pushes some of the responsibility back onto employers to look at who they've got in their workforce, who are parents, which will be a considerable number of people probably. And how do we support them in terms of understanding good mental health and experiencing good mental health? Because if they haven't had that learning, that awareness outside of work, so they don't know what good mental health looks like or how to achieve it, then actually by providing some of that information in the workplace, they can, that opens up their eyes, their understanding, and they will be hopefully role modeling that and sharing that at home. But it's also about if they are experiencing challenges outside of work, with perhaps their family are experiencing mental health challenges. Young people we know are experiencing more and more challenges these days. So actually how that parent coming into work, half their brain is preoccupied with worrying about their son or their daughter and what's going on for them. They're only partly present at work, and how tolerant are we of that? So that's kind of the stuff we're going to be talking about today. And I guess part, I want to unpick that a little bit with you about, you know, in work, what can we do to support, to educate, to have empathy for a considerable amount of our workforce? And I think that what triggered that for me is when I read a report recently, and I've got some stats here. So the Resolution Foundation report, and I posted about this on LinkedIn a couple of weeks ago, but they were finding that people in their early 20s are more likely to not be working due to ill health than those in their early 40s. So it suggests that even though we've got all this emphasis and we talk so much about mental health and getting it right, and there's been so much of a focus on it over you know, recent years. I'm not sure how long recent is, but it seems like we've been talking about this for a long time, relatively, but still young people are having challenges with it to the extent that it's stopping them going to work. There are some quite shocking stats that 1 in 20 young people were economically inactive due to ill health in 2023. And 79% of 18 to 24 year olds who are workless due to ill health only have qualifications at GCSE level or below. So there's some kind of, you know, and there was another one, if children aged 11 to 14 suffer poor mental health, they're 3 times more likely not to pass 5 GCSEs, including them English and maths, compared with healthy children. So we've got to understand how to support young people, children, better so they can get their GCSEs, because if we can get their GCSEs, they're more likely to experience better mental health and get into the workplace. But that's affected a huge amount by parents, and parents pretty much go to work. So what can companies, or what should companies, or should they be doing something to support those parents? What are your thoughts when you hear those kind of those numbers?
Well, I think first and foremost, say for example, the 14 to 17 year olds not achieving their GCSEs, what's their socioeconomic demographic? I think like a huge amount of this is mental health related, that is actually like your basic needs not being met. Like I like did not perform well at school, but it was really hard to care about Pythagoras' theorem if you didn't know you're going to have a sober parent when you got home.
Yeah.
And the part of the problem with that is, of course, like economic downturn creates instability, which inevitably creates like chronically stressful childhoods. And therefore, children are far more likely to underperform at school when they have stressful home lives. So I think we need to look at, like, when we talk about support, like are people being financially compensated fairly?
Mm.
With, and like, I'm hard to not jump on my socialist like soapbox on this. I work with like the Liberal Democrats, and I, you know, talk about this stuff all the time. When I talk about, you know, when you look at like the rise of pay for someone who's a CEO compared to the rise of pay as a percentage of the workforce, like that's atrocious.
Mm.
Like the reason why parents are working so much is because the cost of living is so high.
Mm.
And if you can't understand that, if you can't understand why so many parents are having to work so hard under so much stress, and therefore in effect, not by choice, but having to neglect certain elements of home life because they're having to work so hard. But you need to have a like strong look at your privilege, because there are people really, really like fighting to keep their head above water. And that then is inevitably reflected in the children. So I think that, and that's like a very wonderful thing to say like, well, we should pay people more. Like in an ideal world, people would be paid like more than fairly compensated. I'm sure that somebody somewhere has done a study whereby they probably looked at increasing people's pay and the effect that would have on a mental health. And I would say that it's probably had a massively positive effect on people's mental health to be properly financially compensated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a scathing indictment of the world that we live in, that we have to have a minimum wage. Like what's the bare minimum I can pay this person to do what I need them to? Why do we even need to have that? Like, why can you not just pay people properly for the work that they do? Mm-hmm. So I think that parents who have to work that hard, like constantly, it's like really difficult. And, you know, I'm self-employed, and there are times where I have to pick between doing fun stuff with my daughter and turning my laptop on and sitting and doing really boring work I don't really want to do. Like, I want to go to the beach and run around, babe, but I can't because I've got to do this.
Mm.
And so, because I've got to earn money, I've got to put food on the table, got to keep a roof over our head. So people's basic needs need to be met so that they can then meet the needs of their children. Like, that's ultimately it. When a parent has to pit between their children and meeting their basic needs, like, that becomes a problem. And that was a discussion with the NHS nurses pay, wasn't it? Whereby they're basically asking nurses to pit between their children and their job. Any parent is going to start just picking their children. And that was a really interesting conversation there. So that, I think that we have to be really, really aware of what it is that the financial situation, the current economic state that we are in. We have more people living in poverty than ever before. We have more people using food banks than ever before. If you have more people using food banks than ever before, inevitably you're going to have more people failing at school than ever before. Like that is a byproduct of that. And like that's not some psychological theory, John. This isn't some Freudian thing. This is neurobiologically observable behavior.
Yeah. And I think it'd be really interesting, actually, for I remember having a conversation with a guy, Dave Greenaway, who is a great coach, and he was talking about a food bank service that he's part of supporting. And he was saying that people would be surprised at who's coming in and accessing those. So everyone, it's very easy to have a perception of the type of person who might access a food bank. But he said they are professional people coming in and accessing food banks. And my question would be, actually, how many employers know how many of their workforce, how many of their employees are doing multiple jobs just to get enough income to pay their rent or provide food for their family? How many of them are relying on food banks? You know, just having that awareness of someone's not just coming into my organization, doing the job I can see them doing, and then tootling off and then spending time with their family. The reality is probably quite different, or possibly quite different. How many of them have that knowledge? I suspect many don't.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah. And that, like, how many employers actually would put out an anonymous survey because they want to find out the percentage of their workforce that are actually, their needs are being adequately met by this full-time job they have to do? They're exchanging 9 to 5, sometimes 5 days a week of their life to this. Are they actually being financially compensated so outside of that they can lead a fulfilling life, which ultimately is going to make them a better, more satisfied, happier worker? And if they're not, what are you doing and how are you doing that? But I wonder, and it's, if it's an anonymous survey, how many of you are currently using food banks? How many of you are currently in requirement of some sort of state benefit? How many of you are currently taking a second form of employment to fund? How many of you have a dependent who is incapable of working? How many of you care for a child? How many of you have children who require additional needs? Like, I'll guarantee most companies don't have that information, even though it's completely anonymous, because they would probably look at that and go, oh my God, like 15% of our workforce are using food banks. That's a problem. Like, we're not paying people enough money. I completely agree. So that around that support isn't just support for the parent who's having to work ridiculous hours to try and put food on the table. The support is also for the managers to understand what is actually going on, what their company actually looks like from the inside, like what is really going on. Because of course, I tend to find the information that is supplied to people in positions of authority is everything's great. Here's all the good news. Don't be angry at me. Here's all the good news. Like, there's a smidgen of bad news, but don't worry about that. But you don't really need to, the good news isn't the stuff that's going to topple you. It's the bad news. That should be the focus. Like, what can we work on? Is that all going great? Okay, cool. I don't really need to know about that. What do I actually need to know? What's actually not working? No, I get that. That's fantastic. Thank you for telling me that that's working. Lovely stuff. What's not working? Oh, I want to have more bad news, or at least more work on point than I do good news. We've made a 30% increase of profits. Cool. Don't need to know anymore. What's the bad stuff? And the bad stuff would be our workforce are really struggling. Like, we're really, really struggling. We don't have enough. We don't have purpose. And what we're doing, we've got people struggling at home. Like, we're in economic downturn. Like, what can we do to support these people? We have full-time working parents here, and that's, you know, incredibly challenging. On our work from home or our hybrid working isn't allowing for these people. There are people with children who have additional needs, who need to be picked up by a parent at 3 o'clock every day. But because we don't allow for that, they're only then working here part-time, or they're not making enough money, or whatever it might be. So the support.
Imagine managers when they're having their one-to-ones being like really well-developed managers. And so that when they have their one-to-ones, they are quality one-to-ones. And part of that is knowing their team so well that they know how many jobs people are working. They know if they have children, they know what their children are like in terms of, do they have additional needs? And what toll is that taking? Asking, gosh, that sounds tough. How does that impact on you as a parent? Having just normal conversations like that, which open up so much awareness around this person on my team who might be, I don't know, doing my PR stuff or my HR stuff, whatever, actually got all this other stuff that they're dealing with. And maybe I need to cut them a bit of slack. Maybe I need to think about what can we do as an organization to support you in your role in terms of what you need, because you will then be a better employee for us, because you're not going to be resenting what you're having to do or trying to make it fit around stuff that isn't working for you. You can be a better parent because you're able to meet the needs of your child and do what you need to do there. And of course, that's going to have a positive impact on that young person as they grow up.
Yeah, I remember Georgina was involved in an incident from school, and she had to be collected from school, and sort of social services got involved. It was all a much ado about nothing. And I had this phone call from county services in Colchester saying, "You need to come." And I was in Andover in Army headquarters. This is when I was at the mental resilience. And this is in the Army mental health team. And one of the civilian women was my direct chain of command who was running it. And I said to her, listen, this has happened. I've got to go and collect my daughter. And she went, you don't have any leave days left.
You can't believe it.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm going anyway. Like, have me charged. Like, because I will go there, because you can, at any point as a soldier, if you're being charged, you can request to take it further. I go, court-martial me. Stand me up, genuinely stand me up in a military court, and I will explain why I went technically AWOL to go and collect, because that was the response I was given. Nobody in the military would charge me for that, but that was the attitude that was taken in what is supposed to be the pinnacle, the forefront of Army understanding of positive health behaviours, of welfare of soldiers. And the instant response to that was, you don't have any leave days left.
Which is shocking. And I think people listening to that will go, oh, well, gosh, of course we're not like that in our company. And of course we're different. And of course, if someone was in that situation, one of my employees, then I say, yeah, that's fine. Go and collect your daughter, or go and sort out whatever the issue is. However, are they then supporting them when they then come back to say, right, you've been away for however long doing whatever. Are you still okay with your workload? Is there anything we need to help you with? Because you don't know what's gone on. So they've gone off. Children's services have been involved. So it could be something quite serious. Actually, how much support then when they come back, that person comes back in? Or is there a phone call home to say, are you okay? Like, is everything all right? To show that you care. Mm. And then to make sure that when they come back in, do they need any adjustments? Like, are they still okay with their deadlines? Because they might have had something that's supposed to be presenting tomorrow. They haven't had time to put it together because they've had to whiz out to go and get their child. So how much are we engaging with that person at a human level, which is, gosh, you've just been dragged off to do something pretty significant because your need is somewhere else. What can we do to support? And it's really simple. You break it down to that level.
But then the question is, why are we so devoid of basic empathy?
Mm.
Like what? Like, so first and foremostly, grind culture or like hustle culture can just get in the bin. Mm. Like the people who promote and push that are just, it's delusional. Sometimes I find it's like on another planet of, I don't push that. I don't encourage that. I can't stand it. And I will actively speak out against it. If you want it enough, you will go and get it. No, that's not real world. Like, and that's ridiculous. So when we're like pushing this narrative of, can you have some empathy? Why are people void of it in the first place? Like, why is this not a basic thing that we're teaching people? Somebody, imagine you're that person and you've had to go and manage something and then you've come back and how would you want people to treat? Why are people so incapable of having that conversation with themselves? Why is that process not happening? Why are they not reflecting on situations? So then are we talking about, for managers, are we talking about giving them an understanding of emotional intelligence? Are we actually talking about encouraging therapy for managers? Like, because therapy encourages all of those processes, like an understanding of self and then an understanding of other people, the empathy, all of the big things about emotional intelligence, understanding the effect you can have on the room, how do I treat the most vulnerable people in the room, like positive behaviors, how do I show that? Like, that's ultimately what we're talking about. We're talking about like basic human interactions within a workplace. Like, how do we make the workplace better for people with kids? Well, like, develop a sense of emotional intelligence and do that through like hire the psychologists, hire the therapists, hire the coaches, hire the people who are going to encourage emotional intelligence, rather than this insane narrative that like, if you work hard, like you just have to keep working hard. You have to work harder and work harder and work harder. That's ridiculous. You know, I know that it's a common metric used is house prices. If you work hard enough, you can get there. Can you?
Mm.
Like, can people get there? Is that a fair analogy of that? Is that a fair way of looking at it? You can get there. Mm. Like, you could in the early 90s,
mm.
but people can't now. That's not as simple as that.
And also, it just means that people are constantly striving for something else. It's like, I've got to keep working harder and better and pushing myself to make sure I can get that thing,
yeah,
which I still be out of reach. And I think going back to your, question about why are people not demonstrating more empathy? Why are we not experiencing that? People just don't have time and space. There's that sense of the pressure we are under, how much there is to do on our to-do list, yeah, inside and outside of work, but in a work context, to have those meaningful conversations, just take a step back and just go, wow, I wonder how that person's really feeling right now because of, that meeting they've just had or the call they've just had or whatever's going on. I wonder how that person's really feeling and what's going on for them and what I can do to help. That takes firstly space on my part to do that and self-awareness. And then I've got to create space to go and have that conversation with them. And the space is the one thing we know isn't happening. It doesn't happen in workplaces, which is why Jem and I have set up our leadership labs where we're creating that space where leaders come together or managers come together and they're talking about, this is what it's really like for me. And actually, I need to understand a little bit more about how to have a good conversation that shows empathy and demonstrates my emotional intelligence and, all that stuff. Because if we don't build it into our diary and almost build in, I need to have some space to check in with my team or just to, reflect on where I'm at, it doesn't happen. It's like meeting, 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 deadline.
Yeah, and you're right, and we just have to be. I think from my perspective, I'm doing like lots of resilience coaching and lots of development around that. That I don't want resilience to almost become like a tool of capitalism to try and make people work harder. Like no. That's not what it's about. Like we need our workforce to be more resilient. We're having 30% of our workforce is taking time off for mental health issues. Yeah, but you're also paying them the bare minimum. So like, I don't want this to become something that you're then using to hit people over the head to get them to work harder for your company to make you more money. That's not fair. Just because you've got Stockholm syndrome for a system that has now eventually started benefiting you, like, doesn't mean that these people have, and they've got lives. Like, actually, a huge amount of resilience is about emotional intelligence and understanding yourself. And if these people need time off, they need time off. Mm. And actually, perhaps the resilience training should be aimed at the management so that you can understand what it means to be a fulfilling good leader, rather than using resilience to try and beat people with. Like, it's not a whip, so you can hit people harder.
Mm. No, I completely agree. I did a talk about resilience for a network several years ago, and I stood and said exactly the same thing. This is not about making your workforce more resilient so you can just shove more at them and expect them to cope. It's like, how do we get, if we make our environment right, it automatically helps people become more resilient. Mm. So one of the things, you know, we talked about a bit about kind of supporting our employees. And I'm guessing, I'm also just thinking about our companies have social responsibility. And I'm wondering about people within an organization. I'm thinking about this as well from like one of my first jobs was being a teacher. And I had some kids who came from home lives where there were no aspirations. It goes back to what you're saying about emotional needs. So a sense of, you know, what am I aspiring to be or to experience in my life? And they had no ambition, and their parents didn't either, because their parents didn't believe stuff was possible. Again, that's just in their own experience. So we would get people from the local companies, local organizations, who had something to say, to come in and just mentor young people, to sit with them and have a conversation about, you know, so it sounds like your schoolwork's not going really well, or it sounds like you're struggling a bit with some friendships or whatever the issue is. Let me tell you a little bit about my story, and let me tell you a bit about some of the stuff that might help. And actually, just to have positive role models, which are not necessarily of the kids, of the parents in your organization, but it's in your community.
Mm.
So actually, that's really powerful.
Massive. So, but like, firstly, like, I read an article about like the rise of nihilism within poverty, and I was reading it. I was like, yeah, yes, obviously, it's like the most obvious. Yeah, of course, people who have literally no future apart from like minimum wage jobs, who have no like live in poverty, live in abject misery. Like, yeah, they're going to become nihilistic. They're not going to see the point in life or existence of obviously. So like that. So yeah. So the more desperate your existence is, the more desperately you're going to think about yourself, for sure. And secondly, so to that, I do some charity work with a charity called Lasny Dads. So it's for young men who grew up without father figures. And, you know, they go into this hall and they play a bit of basketball and we sit down, we have conversations. But there's kids going in and going like, I'm really struggling with my science homework. And like one of the guys in there happens to be a physics teacher or whatever it might be. And he'd be like, bring it in. And he sits with him and he does his science homework with him, helps him write this, whatever it is. Another guy's like, oh, my bike's broken again. And they have like a couple of mechanics in there. And go, yeah, we can fix that. And they'll teach them how to like fix it. And they have these conversations, like start every night, start with a conversation about how it is that you're feeling, what's going on, like rate yourself from like 1 to 5 and then what's going on. And like, you know, these, you know, some of these kids, you know, are, dad is, you know, been absent, or, you know, dad's in rehab or whatever it might be. And they want to just say like, I'm having a really bad day today. Mm. And it's just accepted and go, okay, cool. And you have these guys stand up. And one of the things we do is there's the MMA gym that I go to, the Combat Institute. And you bring the lads in and teach them just a little bit of kickboxing and a little bit of MMA style stuff, you know, like Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you know, like here's how you bring someone to the ground and strangle them. Like it's all done, obviously, in a completely safe environment. Mm. It's all properly managed and everyone's DBS checked and all that type of stuff. But then these kids, and then we sit around and have these conversations. How are you feeling? What's going on? How did you get on with that? How did you get on with this? You know, one of the guys is like, oh, I want to be a music producer. But one of the mentors, it's so like the dads who come in, the mentors, is a DJ. Like he's DJed at Ministry of Sound. Mm. And he's like, well, why don't, now that he's now his mentor and he now teaches him about music. So these kids, like, their needs are being met, and what they want is being met by these guys and showing that there is a positive way out. You know, like, when you look at, like, my journey, I think when I look at my journey objectively, it's like Orwellian nightmare, like, be homeless or join our army. By the way, we're sending you to a war that we know we're never going to win. So, like, go and fight in our unwinnable war or be homeless. Like, that's a dystopian nightmare. That's what George Orwell wrote about. And then, you join the military, and the military provided me with a platform. But actually, and particularly in my book, I talk about this all the time, that the things that really got me there, the things that really, like, supported and offered me and gave me these opportunities were my friends, were, like, these really positive role models around me who would push me in certain directions, open certain doors, encourage me to go for certain things, and train me and educate me and help me. Like, that's where that strength is. So being able to create that network, whether it be in your company and extending outside of the company, which is something that they used to do. Like, working for a company used to be part of a community. I grew up on one of the estates I grew up on was called Smith's Estate. And Smith's used to make, I think it was like concrete or something like that. But basically, all of the workforce used to live on this estate, much like an army pads estate that then became part of the institution that was then that social support for people. So all the and I know this is very 1950s, but, like, the men would go off to work and all the women would, like, support and help each other. And there was that community there that was supported by the company, and the company would have regular activities and community days, much like you still see in the army. They have open days and community days and family days. And there's that family bond. And one of the really interesting studies that we did when I was working as a mental resilience coach was to reveal that the people least likely to suffer with mental health conditions were the Fijians and the Gurkhas. And the reason for that was because it was believed just because they have such close family units. They felt so supported with, they created these support networks where it was all very, very genuinely mutually supportive. So effectively, if you want to help parents in your workforce, particularly if they have difficulty with their children with additional needs, you have to be able to support them and create that support network for them that isn't necessarily just a supervisor, but it's actually multi-level.
I couldn't agree more with that. And I think actually just hearing you talk, it just reminds me as well of opportunities that companies have to create those communities in-house where, you know, let's look at the challenges that our workforce has experienced. So we talked about food banks, we talked about money. Imagine having someone coming in and just running some workshops around budgeting and kind of, you know, how kind of financial well-being, but also stuff like teams. You know, I had a meeting this morning. I was chatting to someone else about, you know, one of my friends has recommended some really good books around bringing up teenagers that are for parents, but also for the teenagers to understand their parents when they're going through the teenage years. And this other guy was like, oh my gosh, pass that on to me. So imagine the number, you know, if you had a workshop in a company, which is like, do you want to better understand your teenagers? I think a lot of people would probably put their hands up. And you come along and you share some resources. You just talk about what life is like being a parent of a teenager. And you start to get that little community going who can just talk about, and I'm being screamed at all the time at home, or my child stopped talking to me overnight and I don't know what I'm doing wrong, or I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
That sense of empathy and support and just being able to share some resources and just being able to normalize this experience. It's not me that's got a problem. It's not unique to me. It's like, wow, this is the other people are in the same boat. And imagine having those opportunities around needs that are just everyday needs, get the right people in to deal with the stuff that most of us are dealing with every day.
Yeah, yeah. And I like the whole parenting of a teenager, because my daughter's now crossed the threshold.
Yeah.
Oh, I really wish her school had rules on makeup, because that would make every fight in the morning with me. Like, they don't have rules. Like, that's up to the parents. And you're like, I get why school is saying that, because every morning to fight with Georgina, she's trying to, like, glue on fake eyelashes to go to school. And we have, like, she will shout at me, and I'm not a shouter. So now I'm just dropping this child off, and I'm now having to spend 10 minutes. Like, I like to read storybooks is like my meditative to, like, calm myself down. I'm having to do that before doing any resilience work with people, because I'm so stressed out. Mm-hmm. And I think I've got having gone through therapy and having gone through the processes and understanding about the importance of calming my central nervous system, I know to do that. But first and foremostly, isn't that great that I can spend half an hour reading some Sharp or some Jack Reacher before I go and work. But first of all, obviously having the time, but secondly, having the awareness. And so there are people then who get shouted at by their teenagers, get into their car, go in, and the first thing they've got is a 2-hour meeting.
I know.
About Manning. And you're just saying, just like, I'm really sorry, I'm just not present. It's fundamentally changing the way that we perceive what it is that the workforce actually needs to achieve, what is considered a good day at work. Because if someone can achieve 10 times the amount that they could have over a month period, sat at home, then why do they even need to come in? Why do they need to do the commute? Why do they need to not be there for their children? Why do they need to do that? And if they can do that, and you're properly financially compensating them for that work, if you are understanding and empathetic to their needs and what their family's needs are, and they're being properly financially compensated, isn't that incredible what you can achieve, and actually the reduction you have in poor mental health? And the reason I think that we're seeing it particularly prevalently in the youth is because things aren't getting better. The cost of living goes up, and the standard of living inevitably is going down. Education's all over the shop. Suicidality is going just through the roof. Still, we're not really working out how we can really get a proper grip of that. And the earth is heating up. But it is, at the moment, it is just a horrible time to be a young person.
So what advice would you, I mean, we've covered quite a lot today in terms of some sort of general ideas. What would be some key takeaways that you would really like people listening to this who have influence in their organization to take away and think, actually, you know what, we need to think about the needs of our workforce in terms of who are parents, how to support them to support their children's needs better, or how to make sure that they've got the right experience so that they're in a better place when they go home to be the parent they need to be for their children?
Yeah, so I think psychoeducation for leaders and managers is really important. So understanding, like a better understanding of human behavior, allows you better not just to reason with yourself, but obviously to allow space for empathy. So rather than seeing things through a bias whereby you're like, well, this is how I did it, like you can do away with that type of language and see things slightly more fairly, as well as understanding people will only ever make you a better manager. There is no downside to a therapeutic process of some sort whereby you begin that psychoeducation to understand yourself, even if it's just book recommendations, like this is how you can understand that, and then speaking to professionals, having people like yourself go in and talk to them about human behavior and what humans do and how we do it and why we do the things that we do, allows people to better understand themselves and better understand their workforce. So you can just have empathy, like emotional intelligence. We assume people have it, but actually the vast majority of people don't, or like we're all lacking in certain situations. Mm-hmm. You know, and actually we could all do with that. But if you've never had any kind of education around emotional intelligence, you're never going to acknowledge that you need it. Mm-hmm. And that's true of all of us, like going through your own psychotherapy, going through my own journey, and you go, oh, I'm the problem. I'm the common denominator here. And actually what I've been doing is wrong, or how I've done this is wrong. And like my friends talk all the time about this huge transformation of character that happened when I realized that. And there was lots of things, like we're all products of our environments, completely understand that, you know, it was a really like abusive childhood, and that fell away, and it made room for just a completely different person and leader and man. And I think, wow, but there are so many people walking around who've had really traumatic childhood experiences. And the way that they manage and lead and run a company is a reflection of that.
I think that point about psychoeducation is so key. And I think I had a coaching session with a very senior director yesterday, and it was our first session together, and I just did some psychoeducation, and he just absorbed it all. It was like a sponge soaking the stuff up, going, you know, getting an insight into how he communicates, into his relationships at work, at home. And it wasn't a very long session, and it was just some kind of high level stuff. But it was like, wow, he'd got to where he's got to in life without knowing any of this stuff. And you just think, actually, if you just gave that knowledge to parents to understand their kids, or if we could influence schools to do it in schools, so that they're all well equipped. You just think the difference that education would make in terms of just having a better understanding of myself and of other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really wonderful point. But yeah, like you're 100%. And one of the things I wish is like, you know, my school, like, really appreciated that. I remember being called like, you are a naughty child. Like, you are a terrible little boy. And I was like, that was year 8. And it was like on the front pages of all the local newspapers that my dad was a drug dealer, had been like this top end organized crime drug dealer, and like had just gone to prison for like 10 years. And then why have you all of a sudden become this absolute nightmare? People don't even want you in the classroom because you are a naughty boy. And like that internalized shame that comes from using that language, because now I'm convinced that there's something wrong with me. Mm. But because now you've just convinced me by using that language, not you've been behaving like a naughty boy by saying you are a bad person, you are a naughty. I've internalized that shame, and I've spent the rest of my life with that internalized shame that I've then projected onto other people when I've been then put in a position of authority in the military, because that's encouraged and accepted behavior, because there's lots of individuals with internalized shame in the military, because that's the environment that they grew up in. Then I go through this therapeutic journey and go, I really wish I'd done things differently. Like, I didn't know, and I'm not judging myself for not knowing, although I obviously, like everybody does when you first realize how bad you've been, you do judge yourself. But you get past that phase and you go, I'm not judging myself for how I behaved. You go, how many people in positions of authority and power walking around with this internalized shame because that's what they were told when they were younger and they've never dealt with it?
And I think that goes back to that whole sense of having an understanding about how we behave, how we show up. Is that about internal stuff, or is that about our environment? And when we get good leaders who look at the fact that our environment plays a huge part in terms of shaping how we behave and how we show up, that then makes the responsibility more of a joint one, rather than this is your problem, you're stressed, or you're managing people badly, or whatever, going to sort yourself out. Well, actually, how can we support that person to perhaps open up some doors in their understanding, their skills, their development, in terms of actually things could be different? Because unless we take people by the hand and join them with where they're at to guide them on that journey, it just comes across being very critical, and then you don't get anywhere.
Right. Yeah. No, massively agree. Massively.
James, we need to wrap up, because we have been talking, and it's like, I've just looked at the clock, it's like, wowzers. Is there anything else you wanted to share in terms of any advice, any recommendations?
So recommendations, I would say, reach out to a therapist, like always, like particularly if you're in a position of power, because actually then you're in a position of power, that there in turn means influence, and you can influence so many people's lives for the better if you're in a position of power. But if you don't fully understand yourself, how can you understand the workforce and the people that you therefore influence? So like, always go and get that professional support, always speak to a professional who can just, all the job is just hold a mirror up to you and say, yeah, but how would that feel for you, and why do you do that? That's basically like the very fundamentals of how you can just take that and just learn to inject that into your own life and challenge your own behaviors and your own perspective, your own attitudes, behaviors and beliefs, which is amazing. So always get the professional support, always speak to those people. And secondly, like, find out who your workforce actually are, like find out who they really are, and not just, I mean, an anonymous survey to find out what percentage of your workforce are actually financially struggling is one thing, but being able to sit and have conversations with them is like a completely different one. And it was something that we covered with Scottish Police in that program. We talked about like active listening skills and how to develop trust within people, and like bringing people in, and like the social etiquette of making someone a brew is actually a really powerful thing, and just being able to sit and have a conversation with someone. I've got a friend and he manages quite a lot of people now, and whenever he has to ask someone to come and speak to him about something, he always puts in there, it's nothing bad, just a chat, smiley face. Just something as little as that, because he knows he's got members of his workforce who are overthinkers. He'll go, the boss has asked me for a chat.
Yeah.
And they will think about it all day. Yeah. Can you come and speak to my office at 3:00? Nothing bad, just a chat, smiley face. Makes like the world of difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they go, something so simple.
Yeah. 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 And they're like, wow, like huge. And like you can ask him about anybody in his workforce. And like, he'll be able to, oh yeah, da 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 da, 3 kids, da 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 da. And there are so many great examples of so many great leaders who genuinely care about their people, who can tell you all about their families and tell you about their private lives, who can and talk about and how they can best support them. And just such a powerful place to be.
It has been brilliant talking to you. I've missed talking to you for so many years, honestly. Yeah. You are super passionate. I can see, as I said before we hit record, you are absolutely in the right space now for pulling together all your skills and your resources and offering a huge amount of support out. So we'll put your contact details in the show notes. But thank you so very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
That's the last episode of season 7. This year is absolutely flying by. So what have you taken from the conversation today with James? Do think about your intentions to do something differently. And do give the podcast a thumbs up on Apple or wherever you listen. I'd be incredibly grateful if you could leave a short review too, as it really helps spread the word far and wide. I'd love you to join the club to be part of driving real change that improves practice and people's experience at work. You'll be the first to hear about relevant updates and free downloadable resources. Please do reach out to me directly to discuss the topics covered on this podcast or perhaps other challenges at work. And if we're not already acquainted on LinkedIn, let's connect. All the links you need are in the show notes. So join me after the Easter break when we'll be kicking off with season 8. Until then, bye for now.